Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, July 15, 2019. Authorities in South Sudan have arrested a journalist.
These people are saying that John Agog is not working with any media house. He has no any media house that is responsible for him, to which deeds he may commit can lay on the shoulder of such a media organization.
And diplomats support efforts to prevent the spread of Ebola from DRC into South Sudan.
We're most worried about what could happen here. And we are here to also offer you our assurances that we will not forget about the struggle and all this hard work that you are doing here. This is on our minds.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The family of detained journalist John Agok Awel is pleading with the Eastern Lake State authorities to release him 5 days after national security operatives arrested him. The Eastern Lake State's deputy governor, Taban Agwel Agwek, says the journalist was detained because he had violated rules set by the national security not to take photos during a public event. Winnie Cherino reports for VOA from Juba.
John Agok's brother, Isaac Malek, says security operatives arrested Agok during a welcoming ceremony of the governor of Eastern Lake State who had just returned from Juba. He says no one explained to the family why Agok was arrested. Malek says family members have repeatedly tried to call police officials heading the detention facility where Agok is being held, but no one pays them any attention. Malek says family members went to the facility again today.
We are just waiting till morning, and they have not come to call Big John Agok to see how the case is going on, whether they are going to open the case or whether they are going to release. Now they have not yet come back. Now we are reaching up to one o'clock, and there is no result.
Malek says after several phone calls made by family members and Agok's work colleagues, the governor promised to release Agok, but nothing has happened. Malek says when Agok was arrested, he was just doing his job.
We need Big John Agok to be released from the prison. So if they don't want to release, so we also want to go and open the case so that we go and see what is the major thing, why the Big John Agok was being arrested. Because someone cannot be arrested with no reason.
Taban Abel Agwek, the deputy governor of Eastern Lake State, says he doesn't know why Agok was arrested, but had security officers say Agok had violated certain rules set by the National Security Service during the governor's reception.
No cameras were allowed to a certain zones, so he violated it and he went there against the directives. Number two, these people are saying that John Agok is not working with any media house. He has no any media house that is responsible for him, to which deeds he may commit can lay on the shoulder of such a media organization.
Agwek says the security operatives claim Agok took pictures of what they call valuable information and was not working for any particular media house at that time. Agwek says when he reaches Ural, he will discuss Agok's detention with the governor. Josephine Achiro, Secretary General of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, says, according to AMDC's database, Agok is a journalist working with Euro Community Radio in Eastern Lake State, even though the station was shut down a few months ago.
AMDC is aware about the arrest of the journalist from Euro Western Lake State. But again, AMDC is not yet clear on why he was detained till now. We are having our media monitoring personnel in Rumbek. He's still following it up for us so that we know exactly what happened.
Achiro says AMDIS has not released a statement concerning Agok's arrest because they didn't have enough information on why he's being detained, but is working with the media authority to ensure his release. She's calling on South Sudan's authorities to charge citizens with an offense rather than detaining them for days without disclosing a reason for their arrest. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Some Foreign envoys in South Sudan are asking Yei River State authorities to work with rebel groups and communities to prevent the spread of the deadly Ebola virus from reaching the state through neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. Health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo reported a week ago the disease killed one person in DRC's market business town of Aliwara, about 40 miles from the South Sudan-DRC border.
Ambassadors from the European Union, the African Union, the US, Britain and Japan visited Yei River State capital of Yei today to help scale up Ebola prevention efforts. At a meeting with local authorities and aid workers in Yei, British Ambassador to South Sudan Chris Trott said if those efforts are going to work, everyone has to get involved, including rebel groups.
To ensure that they understand that they play a supportive role in addressing an Ebola crisis. So they need to be part of our planning. They need to be part of a dialogue that your partnership extends beyond peace, the police, into the military sectors as well, as do the opposition forces in this region, to ensure that we get the response right. And it's a response that reflects the needs of the people who are at risk, including the health workers on the front line.
Trott says the British government will continue funding preparedness activities in South Sudan. Dr. Sinead Walsh, the European Union ambassador to South Sudan, is urging local and state authorities to engage communities to help prevent Ebola from reaching the country.
What I really want to encourage you, and what finally worked for us in Sierra Leone and what worked also very well in Liberia, was a really collaborative approach with communities and community leaders. That is about how do we work together in a spirit of partnership to defeat this? Because the solution to Ebola is at the community level. It's not actually in the clinics. It's not in the border screenings. They are critical and everything. But the solution is in the communities, and only the community. You can see, you want an example? Look at DRC. Only communities who really own the response will defeat this virus.
Tom Hosek, the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, says the Trump administration is committed to providing technical and material support to help fight the spread of Ebola from neighboring DR Congo into Yei River State.
We're most worried about what could happen here. And we are here to also offer you our assurances that we will not forget about the struggle and all this hard work that you are doing here. This is on our minds. Whether it comes in terms of funding, expertise, equipment, or most importantly, partners. We are here. We will make sure that those tools and resources are available to help prevent and to prepare for Ebola here in Yei River State.
Yusto Barba, the acting governor for Yei River State, says insufficient funds and infrastructure remain a major challenge in fighting the spread of the disease, noting that civilians move freely across the South Sudan DR Congo border at many porous entry points.
Protection and transmission of this dangerous disease, EBD, should be right from the point of border entry. There is a need to construct isolation units in all entry points. Provision of a good number of ambulances in all the entry points. Ebola is a threat to everybody, and we are calling upon our brothers in the opposition to allow opening of screening points at their control areas.
Yusto says the Yei River State government has granted free movement to all health and humanitarian workers to prevent the spread of Ebola from reaching rural parts of the state. Dr. Makur Karyom, Undersecretary in the National Health Ministry, agrees that government and opposition officials in the state must work together to fight the spread of Ebola.
It's an enemy to all of us, whether we are rebels or we are government. And therefore, it's important that not only to open up corridors or access routes, but actually to cooperate and work together with the rebels and the opposition to ensure that we actually protect this country.
Karyom says the president has ordered the ministers of defense, interior and national security to ensure access to all humanitarian and health workers. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
Still on Ebola, the head of the World Health Organization says the spread of Ebola to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have dire consequences. The World Health Organization chief spoke on Monday at a high-level meeting that examined current efforts to contain the growing Ebola crisis in Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the meeting in Geneva.
The Ebola outbreak in Congo's conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces is the second largest after the historic 2014 epidemic that killed 11,300 people in West Africa. As the first anniversary of the DRC epidemic draws near, the WHO reports nearly 2,500 people have been infected with the virus and 1,665 people have died. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the effort to stop the spread of the disease has received another blow with the news that the first case of Ebola had been detected in the eastern Congolese city of Goma. He says WHO was informed Sunday that a pastor who had traveled from Butembo was infected with the deadly virus.
The identification of the case in Goma could potentially be a game changer in this epidemic. Goma is a city of 2 million people near the border with Rwanda and is a gateway to the region and the world. We're confident in the measures we're put in place and hope that we will see no further transmission of Ebola in Goma.
But Tedros agrees he cannot be sure of that, and so he says he will reconvene a WHO emergency committee as soon as possible to determine whether Ebola in the DRC poses a global health threat. The co-chair of this high-level conference, UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock, considers a lack of funding and Eastern Congo's dangerous security environment to be the two biggest threats to the anti-Ebola campaign. Recently, two Ebola responders were murdered in their home in the Congolese city of Beni. On the financial front, he notes less than half of the money needed to run the Ebola containment operation has been received, leaving a funding gap of $50 million. Lowcock warns it will not be possible to get to zero cases unless there's a big upturn in the response.
If we don't get an increase in the funding available, treatment centers are going to close. There will be fewer teams to conduct training or to give life-saving vaccinations. There will be fewer mobile teams available to immediately investigate, isolate, treat, and trace each new case, no matter where the disease pops up.
Participants at the meeting agree on the urgent need to stop the Ebola virus now. They say Goma is a warning that will test the health community's response, preparedness, and ultimate ability to prevent further cases of Ebola in that big urban center. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese women say they expect to have a stronger representation in the new government. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what jobs would you prefer your children to take? Why?
Preferably for my own female child, I'd love her to either go for lecturing because of the time, the freedom, because at a point she would also have her own family, and or get to the medical line, sort of, to help her fellow women, which are actually in need.
Currently, you know, there is a lot of opportunity. You may decide this one for your child, and at the end, the child may not have interest, may be in it. So that one may cause a problem in the life of the child.
I would wish that in future they should take up practical jobs, a job that you will really feel the impact on people. I would like, for example, my children to work on the medical field.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese activists are calling on the military and the opposition to open the space so that women can participate in the country's political process. In the past, women say they were not allowed to participate in politics due to cultural norms and other restrictions. They are now saying it's time to give women a chance. Michael Atid has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Some Sudanese women in Khartoum say since Sudan gained independence from Britain in 1956, women have been marginalized and denied a chance to participate in public affairs. They say This was particularly true during former President Omar al-Bashir's 30-year regime. Khartoum-based women rights activist Manal Bashir, who helped mobilize women during the massive sit-in outside army headquarters, says it is the right time for women to engage in politics and speak up of their rights.
We had been oppressed, discriminated within our home, at the regulations even. So we found ourselves lacking behind, and we were aware about this status. So we didn't leave this status behind, but we worked a lot to achieve a change in our life.
Women's rights activist Naimat Abubakar Muhammad says for years women were afraid to join political parties because the environment was not even safe for men. Abubakar says Sudanese women are capable of holding top leadership positions and the conditions are right for women to rise to that level, unlike in the past.
It wasn't safe at all for anyone to practice politics in Sudan during the last 30 years. If you are politicians, that means you will expect that your life is you will go to the prison, you will be detained for a long time, you can be fired from your job. You know, it's all the threat that stop people from being active in political parties.
Sudanese journalist Mashair Ahmad says certain cultural norms in Sudan have contributed to keep Sudanese women down. Speaking in Arabic, she says women played a key role in overthrowing President Omar al-Bashir. Ahmad says there were voices within Sudanese women who were calling for change in the country. She says they have been working as coalition demanding real change in Sudan. Ahmad says they wanted to surface as women leaders in the society. Even though this will be against some cultures, but Ahmad insists still women have decided not to be behind again. The proposed power-sharing deal between the Transitional Military Council and the opposition stipulates that women representation in the Legislative Council should be at least 40%. Bashir praises the move, but fears there may not be enough qualified women to fill 40% of the country's legislative seats.
It is good that the agreements mention some percentage for women, be it 30% or 40%. So there is good signal that there is the woman will be given a quota. But it is important enough is to fill this quota with quality representation.
Bashir and Abubakar both say Sudan's transitional government of the national unity should be more open to women so they can help rebuild a new Sudan. Abubakar insists the Sudanese revolution has opened a new era and women should feel the political change in the next few years.
It's opened the country for democracy, rule of law, justice, and all this in the benefit of women. So if we really start this long journey to democracy, I'm sure that women's position in general will be changed.
Women activists are calling on the Transitional Military Council and the opposition to sign the power-sharing deal soon so that women and other Sudanese can begin building the new Sudan that many citizens fought and died for. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Analysts and business owners in Central Africa say although the African Free Trade Area launched in Nigeria at the recent African Union summit brings hope to Pan-Africa, the free trade area has been plagued by corruption, national ego and limited movement which has stunned the initiative. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the Cameroonian town of Kiosi on the border with Gabon and Equatorial Guinea.
Hundreds of travelers and business people are at the Cameroon town of Kiosi waiting for the Equatorial Guinea border to be opened for them to cross over with their goods. Kiosi shares the border with Gabon and Equatorial Guinea, and quite often, authorities in Gabon and Equatorial Guinea seal their borders without any comment. Last December, Equatorial Guinea sealed its borders for a month. That same month, Gabon was expelling foreign citizens, especially Cameroonians, from its territory for what they called security reasons. Gabonese-born Gabriel Ndongma, who buys building material from Cameroon and supplies for his country and Equatorial Guinea, says he does not understand why the borders have to be sealed and people chased away when Central African states have a common monetary and economic community created to facilitate movement and trade.
Il faut effacer ce mauvais esprit-là qui plane dans la sous-région que le Cameroun.
He says leaders of the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC, should be serious for once and take strong political decisions that will make it possible for their people to travel freely among Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, Central African Republic, Cameroon and Congo, which belong to their 6 member states economic bloc. CEMAC was created in 1994 and became operational after all member states ratified the treaty creating it in 1999. It has a population of about 45 million and covers a surface area of 3 million square kilometers. CEMAC officially became a free trade zone in 2000 when it announced movement of goods, services, capital and persons was now free. In 2017, the Central African Economic and Monetary Community said it had reached a key milestone after heads of state meeting in Chad lifted visa requirements for their citizens traveling within the 6-member regional bloc. Chadian-born transporter Bismau Halidu says besides the regular closure of borders by some states in the region, non-tariff barriers have made the free interstate trade difficult to take off.
Il est souvent arrivé que lorsqu'on parle de vol, lorsqu'on parle de falsification, lorsqu'on parle un peu voilà, de tout ce qui n'est pas dans le bon sens des mœurs.
He says there are high levels of corruption among police, tax and customs officials in all Central African states. He also notes that surprisingly, Cameroon, which should pilot the integration process because it has a population of more than 25 million, more than half the region's total, is viewed as a country not to be trusted because it is notoriously corrupt. Daniel Onah-Ondo, president of the CEMAC Commission, says security challenges are making it difficult to ensure free movement that can deepen economic integration for its citizens. He says carnage has continued in CAR. Boko Haram terrorism has continued along Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, and the separatist crisis has killed thousands in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon.
Aucun investisseur ne viendra chez nous s'il y a le désordre. Nous avons besoin de paix. Mais bien sûr,
he says the region remains a place where pools of tensions and war make entrepreneurs scared to come and invest, sell or buy. He says it is still very difficult for people and goods to move freely because commuters are harassed by rebels and terrorists, and at times, security forces who are supposed to protect them. Chadian-born Fatima Haram Asil, CEMAC Commissioner for Trade and Industry, says Central Africa is one of the poorest regions in the world, with 70% of the population living on less than $1 a day and 30% of the people going hungry. He says the challenges faced by the region require industries that still are not very competitive, either be developed or be knocked out of the market.
We're going to have a big continental market in Africa. So it's very, very important for us to protect ourselves.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kiosi, Cameroon.
We now turn to Zimbabwe, where the country is experiencing its worst power shortages in years, forcing many people to work at night when electricity is reliable. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the government blames the shortages on businesses and industries for not paying their bills.
Most parts of Harare get electricity for only 7 hours per day, and the hours usually come during the overnight when there is less usage and power stations can meet demand. Once the electricity comes on around 10 p.m., Harare lives up to its local title as the city that never sleeps. For the next 5 to 8 hours, businesses that need electricity to function spring to life even on cold, blustery winter nights. Nelson Mujue, who manufactures door and window frames, says he's recovering from a cold he caught while working overnight. He has an appeal to President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
If the government can give us electricity during the day, I think we can be able to meet our targets. Because actually we are actually getting some orders from clients and we won't be able to meet our targets. Yeah, I've missed a lot of targets and I've got complaints from a lot of clients. They think I'm being slow with my work, but there are some factors affecting us. Of course, they know there are some factors, but they think sometimes the client will think he's lying, he's busy doing something for someone else.
Other business owners say they have tried to use generators so that they can work during the day. But fuel, like many other basic goods in Zimbabwe, is scarce and expensive. This week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa dispatched his energy minister, Fortune Chasi, to negotiate with Mozambique and South Africa to provide more electricity to Zimbabwe. Harare hopes the talks will bear fruit after it paid $10 million in debt to South Africa last month. Chasi says the government can only retire the remaining debt of $70 million to South Africa if citizens pay about $100 million they owe to the country's utility company, the Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, ZESA.
We all need to pay our debts to assure ourselves of power. I also want to make a specific public appeal to commerce and industry. They also owe significant amounts of money, and we would, without power, they can't operate. And when they don't operate, life becomes very difficult for all of us.
While experts say the economic impact of the ongoing power shortage is not clear, they say the moribund economy will suffer even more if the situation is not quickly addressed. Mujua will suffer as well from loss of income and possibly clients, and from the effects of working in the cold and long winter nights. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
Yes, we have a WhatsApp number and we would like to hear from you. The number is +1 202 630 8011. That's our show for this Monday. We leave you now with the song All the Girls by Jose Chameleon.
Chameleon in a Davido, Parivara, it's how we go. Call all the girls, Davido, they so you call all the girls. All of my guys, all of your girls, come to my place so you let us relate. We do it now, Bangolo. All of the girls want to Bangolo.
I'm coming to you.
Baby, oh, baby, now we be to blow. I can never leave you lonely. Baby girl, come be my homie, and I'll take you far and wide. Baby girl, what you desire? Baby, you be hot like fire. It is your love that make me tired. All my lele ladies, put this song on your playlist. All I want you, I need.
We've been listening to Jesse Chameleon with the song All the Girls. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Bangalore, all of the girls want to